KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. We'll have live special coverage of President Trump's remarks at the NATO summit, where European leaders announced increases to their defense spending to counter threats from Russia and China. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. A new group of vaccine advisors to the CDC meets today. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. It's their first meeting after Health Secretary RFK Jr. fired all the members of the old panel. Critics say some members of the new panel aren't qualified or are biased. Also, a new biography of the late Virgil Abloh tells the story of how a fashion outsider made it to the top of the world's largest luxury brand. It is Wednesday, June 25th. On this day in 1996, Jay-Z released his debut album, Reasonable Doubt. It was not considered an immediate success, but critics now call it a classic. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says the intelligence is inconclusive about U.S. strikes on Iranian nuclear sites, but Israel's military says the war has pushed Iran's nuclear program years backward. A U.S. intelligence assessment finds the strikes set the program back a few months. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports.
In a briefing, Israel's military spokesman Effi Defrin said Israel is still assessing the damage, but that Israel estimates, quote, we set Iran's nuclear program years back. He did not refer to the U.S. strikes on Iran. A U.S. official not authorized to speak publicly told NPR early assessments found U.S. strikes on Iranian nuclear sites set back its enrichment program a few months. Also, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised Israel's last major blitz in Iran shortly before the ceasefire went into effect, despite criticism of those attacks from President Trump. Netanyahu said the bombings were, quote, the hardest blow of all since the start of the war, killing hundreds of Iranian security officials and besieged militia members. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jerusalem.
New vaccine advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are holding a public meeting on vaccine policy today and tomorrow. NPR's Ping Huang reports it's got public health advocates on edge.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fired the previous panel 2 weeks ago after he announced that he was changing the vaccine schedule without their input. Jason Schwartz at the Yale School of Public Health says all these changes point to a major shift.
Everything we've seen signal a real retreat from the federal government's historical role as active supporters and champions of the nation's vaccination effort.
Kennedy has named new members to the panel, including some who have spread false claims that COVID vaccines are killing people or causing cancer, which, again, is not true. The panel's recommendations affect which vaccines get covered by health insurance and what kids have access to. Ping Huang, NPR News.
The makers and sellers of wedding dresses are expressing concerns about their costs in the wake of President Trump's global tariffs. They're asking the administration to protect formal wear from the new levies. NPR's Elena Selyuk reports most bridal gowns sold in the United States are made abroad.
China is by far the biggest hub for bridal gowns, and not just dresses, but also trims and crystals, veils and hair pieces. Many brands have already started raising prices to offset tariff costs. Some stores are still absorbing them. Others have begun charging brides. Chelsea Ritchie, who's dress shopping in Los Angeles, is getting warnings of likely tariff surcharges.
Maybe an additional, I'm hearing somewhere between $200 to $1,000. It really just depends on the price. But I'm going to be honest with you, that was a pretty big blow to hear.
The Bridal Retailers Association says tariffs will not bring gown-making jobs to the U.S., given the highly limited pool of skilled craftsmen for hand-beading, embroidery, or lace work. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Leaders at the NATO summit in the Netherlands have agreed to spend far more money on defense spending. President Trump has pushed each country to commit to spending 5% of its GDP every year for defense and security. The massive spending increase is supposed to happen within a decade. The NATO leaders also reaffirmed their commitment to the alliance's principle of mutual self-defense. That is, an attack on one NATO country is considered an attack on all of them. Well over 100 million people are under heat alerts from the National Weather Service. Forecasters say extremely dangerous heat reaches from the central U.S. into the East Coast. Some places will see heat values well into the triple digits. From Vermont Public Radio, Abigail Giles has more.
Northern New England is famous for its mild summers, but the region is seeing more frequent and hotter heat waves because of human-caused climate change. Steamy overnight temperatures like the ones this week are especially dangerous for older people, pregnant people, and people experiencing homelessness. But heat waves are also bad for the economy, says Dartmouth climate scientist Justin Mankin.
Our best estimate is that an extreme heat event generally lasts, in terms of its economic impacts, about 3 years.
Mankin says heat waves can put farmers in debt, hurt public infrastructure, and make workers less productive. That's especially so in places that are not prepared for them. For NPR News, I'm Abigail Chiles in Burlington, Vermont.
On Wall Street in pre-market trading, Dow futures are flat. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The world is now watching Israel's conflict with Iran. In a few moments, we'll turn to Israel's other front in Gaza. First, President Trump says U.S. airstrikes in Iran wiped out that country's nuclear program.
But some U.S. national security sources have a different assessment, and the White House is pushing back hard against anyone who disagrees.
For more, we're joined by NPR's Greg Myrie. So, Greg, President Trump's position is pretty clear. Iran's nuclear program was, quote, completely obliterated. So who's saying otherwise?
Yeah, a U.S. official speaking on condition of anonymity tells our NPR colleague Tom Bowman that the Defense Intelligence Agency believes the damage was limited at Iran's most important nuclear site, Fordo. The official says Iran's program has probably been set back by just a few months or so. Now, the Defense Intelligence Agency is part of the Pentagon. This is a preliminary assessment. It's considered low confidence at this point. And the DIA doesn't speak for the entire intelligence community. Other intelligence agencies like the CIA are not commenting, but they're also gathering information. There will be multiple assessments that could change and evolve over time.
All right. So what's the White House saying?
Yeah, the White House is not happy about this. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt said, quote, this alleged assessment is flat out wrong. But she then went on to say that the report was leaked by someone in the intelligence community. So she seems to be confirming the existence of the report. Now, Trump repeated his position today at the NATO summit in the Netherlands.
I believe it was total obliteration. I believe they didn't have a chance to get anything out because we acted fast. If it would have taken 2 weeks, maybe, but it's very hard to remove that kind of material.
We should also note that the ceasefire in Israel and Iran both seem to be holding now for a second day.
Now, if we can get clarity on these key nuclear sites bombed by the U.S., would that settle the all-important questions about the state of Iran's nuclear program?
Well, not entirely. You know, these are the three most important sites, Fordo, Natanz, Isfahan. They're about 100 to 300 miles south of the capital, Tehran. But Iran's nuclear network has many parts. Israel bombed many of them before the U.S. struck over the weekend. There's no doubt that every piece of Iran's known nuclear program was targeted and apparently suffered at least some damage. But there are still questions. For example, the U.N.'s nuclear watchdog agency, the International Atomic Energy Agency, recently said Iran has about 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium. Now, this would need to be enriched a little bit more, but it could be used to make multiple bombs. This material could be moved fairly easily, and the Iranians may have hidden it before the U.S. and Israeli attacks.
All right, so what are Iran and Israel saying about the nuclear program?
Yeah, Iran has not made any pledges to shut down the nuclear program, and reports in the Iranian media cite officials saying the country will press ahead. Iran will have to make its own damage assessments and figure out the costs and risk of restarting the program. And Israel has not publicly offered a detailed assessment, but Iran's nuclear program was target number one. I'll add the U.S. and Israel share a lot of intelligence when it comes to Iran. They'll develop a strong sense of where the program is headed, but that's likely to take time.
All right, that's NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thanks.
Sure thing.
Democrats were fuming after the White House postponed two briefings about those U.S. strikes on Iran's nuclear program. A briefing is now scheduled to take place tomorrow for senators and on Friday for members of the House. The top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner of Virginia, told All Things Considered last night he has a lot of questions.
What next if you don't take them out all in the first strike? What are the next steps? How do we make sure that there's not Iran racing now to a dirty bomb? These are questions that we, and frankly, the American people, deserve answers to.
Let's hear from another lawmaker on one of the Intelligence Committees, Congressman Mike Quigley of Illinois. He's a Democrat and serving on the House Intelligence Committee. Good morning, Congressman. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
So you heard Senator Warner's questions. Do you have any others?
I think they have to own up to the fact that the truth matters. Just the fact that the president's ego may be dinged by the fact that his initial statements weren't correct, it really doesn't matter. You got to put your ego in your pocket. You have to face the threats as they exist, not as the president's ego maintains.
Have you heard or do you have any visibility yourself into the extent of the damage done to Iran's nuclear capabilities?
Look, I've been briefed on this as a member of the Intel Committee. We're going to get another briefing Friday morning before the full House gets briefed. And the fact that things may have been leaked doesn't mean that they're not still classified. But what I can say is, look, I've been on the committee 8 years. These strikes are very difficult to evaluate, especially in a denied area. It takes time. These are difficult, hard targets. They're mobile targets. To say they were obliterated before any analysis is fanciful and frankly dangerous. And the IAEA also, beyond saying there were 900 pounds, they said there's probably 30 sites. So what I tried to do was just to make this bipartisan and honest. Senator and Chairman McCall said, I've been briefed on this plan in the past, and it was never meant to completely destroy the facilities, but rather cause significant damage. It was always known to be a temporary setback. Well, I'll add to that. I've been briefed on this many, many times, this kind of plan, on an unclassified basis as well. It was also clear that you were never going to end this program unless you have troops on the ground, and that means a war. So by abandoning diplomacy and the fact that Iran was in compliance before, the president has, in fact, made the situation more dangerous.
You guys have so many questions that we don't have time to answer here, but I was wondering why you think there's such a discrepancy between the administration's version of events and those of the intelligence community. And was it the administration's objective to obliterate the nuclear program? It sounds to me like you're saying, from what you understand, that that just would never have been the case.
What I'm saying is you don't have to read any leaked report or believe that it exists or not. You just know that you cannot obliterate the program with simple missile strikes. And that's what we've acknowledged all along. So what we're facing here is a president, and why we're in this situation, he refuses to ever admit that he's wrong. He wants to be able to say, this is all over and let's move on. It's not that neat. And when you try to do what the president is doing, you put us in a more dangerous situation because we're not dealing with the true threat, a real threat that has to be addressed. It was addressed before diplomatically. It was working. And it's his fault we are now in this situation.
So what would you like to see now? Now we have about a minute left here. What does the U.S. need to do now, in your opinion?
Look, a true assessment, and in the final analysis, we have to move back to diplomacy. There's a lot of things that can move us toward that. Iran is in a weakened state, as are their proxies. Now is the time to push again for diplomacy. It's the only thing that's ever worked. It's the only thing that will work.
That is Congressman Mike Quigley of Illinois. He is a Democrat, and he's a member of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman Quigley, thanks so much for sharing these insights with us.
Thank you.
And I do want to mention that NPR reached out to multiple Republican members of the House and Senate, including those on the intelligence committees, who either declined to be interviewed or did not respond.
Now we take a look at Gaza, where the health ministry there says the number of Palestinians killed in Israeli attacks surpassed 56,000 people, a third of them children. Despite the bloodshed, Gaza's war has fallen out of view in recent days, overshadowed by Israel's war with Iran. NPR's Ea Batraoui in Dubai and Anas Baba in Gaza have more on what people there are saying.
It took just 12 days from the start of Israel's surprise attack on Iran for the war between the two to be called off, with a ceasefire announced by President Trump this week. But it's now day 627 of Israel's war in Gaza, and there are no signs of it winding down or ending. In only the past 24 hours, seven Israeli soldiers were killed, and Gaza's health ministry says more than 90 Palestinians were killed, a third of them shot dead by Israeli forces trying to get food amid severe Israeli restrictions on aid in the territory. Israel's military says it's reviewing some of those shootings. On the ruined, bombed-out streets of Gaza, people have lost hope. Khalil al-Najjar says upon hearing of a ceasefire between Israel and Iran, he said it felt like people in Gaza aren't seen as human, that there's no humanity in the world. He says Gaza's been forgotten and forsaken. That sentiment was echoed by Akram Tabash, who's out of work and going hungry. UN-backed experts on hunger say Gaza is at risk of famine. He says Iran, which supports Hamas, turned its back on the group when it clinched a ceasefire deal with Israel without conditions that the war in Gaza also end. He says he expects Israel's military to strike Gaza even harder now and issue more sweeping evacuation orders. The UN says more than 80% of Gaza is inaccessible to Palestinians or under displacement order by Israel's military. Families of Israeli hostages captured by Hamas in its 2023 attack on Israel say now is the time for a deal that brings them all home and ends the war, saying the government should seize this critical moment. But Israel's far-right government has shown no willingness to permanently end the war. It says Gaza must first be disarmed and Hamas defeated, an elusive and broad war aim that's kept a ceasefire out of reach. Ea Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with Anas Baba in Gaza.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
The new season of the Emmy Award-winning TV series The Bear premieres this week. On the next Fresh Air, we speak with actor Eben Moss Backrack. He's won 2 Emmys for his portrayal of Cousin Richie. He's also appeared in the shows Girls and The Punisher. Next month, he co-stars in the new Marvel movie, The Fantastic Four: First Steps. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Linda Moodbell Learning Center's one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. If I say luxury, especially luxury fashion, what comes to mind? Rich people? Check. Jet-setting celebrities? Sure. So how was it that a streetwear-loving black kid from the outskirts of Chicago with no formal training in fashion became an artistic director at the world's largest luxury brand? Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Robin Givhan has a new book that tells the remarkable story of the late Virgil Abloh, who, before his untimely death in 2021, took streetwear and the career of a fashion outsider to new heights. Givhan's new book is Make It Ours, Crashing the Gates of Culture with Virgil Abloh. And she's with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Robin.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
Why was he such a big deal?
You know, he was a big deal because he was so unusual, because he had not apprenticed at a multitude of fashion houses. He had not studied fashion design. And he really came from the world of T-shirts and hip hop and streetwear. But what he did that was so unusual is normally a company starts out with a garment and they build a brand around the garment. Virgil created a brand and then he proceeded to put products underneath the brand. And because the brand was so powerful, he was able to kind of inject meaning into those products. And it made the people who purchased the products feel seen and feel like their perspective about what was valuable, what was beautiful, was being heard at the highest levels.
Was he kind of the precursor of the celebrity brand in some way, creating a sense of belonging through wearing a garment? You know what I mean? I wear this, mm-hmm. therefore I am connected to all these other people who like the same thing I like.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways he was even better than a celebrity brand. I mean, he was known because he had been an assistant for Kanye West. He was known because he had such an enormous social media presence and because he DJed. But he wasn't really sort of the classic celebrity. And still, he was able to create a brand called Off-White. And he made it so meaningful to people that it didn't really matter that the clothes that came out underneath the brand weren't necessarily that unique. I mean, Off-White was really known for hazard lines, for putting words in quotation marks, for these little red zip ties that were on the sneakers that he made. That's how you really knew who had made the product. It wasn't necessarily the style of the sneaker. It was the zip tie. It wasn't necessarily the cut of the varsity jacket. It was that it had these hazard stripes on the back.
And that was controversial because there were some people who thought that he really wasn't, well, he didn't call himself a designer, right? He called himself a creator or a maker, but he did have his critics, people who thought that you're really not doing anything new here.
I mean, when I was covering his collections, I was one of those critics.
So give us the short version of how Abloh went from an engineering and architecture student from Rockford, Illinois, to become the first black artistic director at the world's largest luxury brand, which is Louis Vuitton.
Yeah, he started out having this sort of serendipitous meeting with Kanye West and sort of got swept up in that circle of people who were wildly ambitious and deeply interested in design. Eventually, he dabbled with his sort of first big t-shirt success with something called Bentril, which was really t-shirts that were made by a DJ collective. And that really informed the way that he worked, this idea that you didn't have to necessarily write the melody or the lyrics. You could take pre-existing ideas and mix them together in new ways and call that your design, so to speak. And then from there, he bought dead stock from Ralph Lauren Rugby, and he silkscreened Pyrex 23 on the back. The original shirt sold for about $40. He sold his versions for over $500.
Oh my goodness.
And they sold out.
How did he become artistic director at Louis Vuitton?
What I think really sort of propelled him into the sight lines of the folks at Vuitton was when he did a collaboration with Nike. And Nike wanted to reissue 10 of their most recognized sneaker styles. And he ended up being responsible for all 10 of these redesigns. You know, Nike is so enormous. It is more recognized than Vuitton as a brand. And when there's a success there, it really reverberates. And that caught the attention of Vuitton.
He died at a very young age, at 41, from a rare form of cancer. He had to have known that his time was short. Do you have a sense of what he thinks his legacy would be?
One of the things that was really remarkable to me, I was able to listen to an interview that Virgil had done back in 2008. And he was talking about how he wanted to mentor people. But even at that early stage of his career, he was thinking about mentoring. And he did that throughout his career. And of course, he also established a scholarship that eventually became part of his legacy.
You're a distinguished fashion writer and a distinguished critic. But inevitably, when we have these conversations about fashion, the question arises, so what? Why do we care about a Virgil Abloh?
Yeah, I mean, we care about Virgil because at the very smallest level, there are kids out there who are making t-shirts or maybe putting stickers on baseball caps. And they love design, they love art, and he is proof that you can take something that simple, gestures that simple, and you can lean into them, and just because you don't have the training or the classical background or all the access that you think you need, that you can still get pretty far in the fashion industry.
That is the Pulitzer Prize winning writer, Robin Givhan. She's senior critic at large at The Washington Post. Her latest book is Make It Ours, Crashing the Gates of Culture with Virgil Abloh. Robin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration wants to strip the name of civil rights icon Harvey Milk from a Navy ship, which critics worry is part of a larger backlash against the LGBTQ community.
It seems extremely vindictive. It's almost as if they want to impact pain on these individuals. It's just very, very unfortunate.
That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. NATO countries have agreed to boost their defense spending. At a summit in the Netherlands today, members of the alliance pledged to boost spending to 5% of their country's gross domestic product by the year 2035, citing threats posed by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. NPR's Lauren Frayer says one of those countries is Britain.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer says one of the things he's spending on is a dozen new U.S.-made F-35 fighter jets capable of carrying nuclear bombs. Currently, the U.K. can only carry such weapons on submarines, having phased out its air capabilities after the Cold War. Now the government is calling this the biggest strengthening of the U.K.'s nuclear posture in a generation. Part of a new national security strategy the government says will, quote, actively prepare for the possibility of the UK coming under direct threat. Lauren Frayer, NPR News, London.
President Trump is attending the NATO summit in The Hague. On the sidelines of the talks, Trump is meeting with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. A spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry is telling Al Jazeera the U.S. military badly damaged three Iranian nuclear sites in Saturday's attacks. Earlier today, President Trump said a preliminary intelligence report on the damage done by the strikes was inconclusive. This is NPR News. A court in Japan today convicted a U.S. Marine of sexually assaulting a woman in Okinawa last year. 22-year-old Lance Corporal Jamel Clayton of Ohio was sentenced to 7 years in prison. Prosecutors were seeking a 10-year sentence. It's going to be hot again today across much of the central and eastern U.S. Afternoon highs in the 90s are likely from Louisiana to New Hampshire. Conrad Lewis with Connecticut Public Radio says heat waves can be more of a challenge in New England, where air-conditioned homes and other buildings are not as common.
Some Connecticut state parks and beaches have had to close because their parking lots are full of visitors. Leslie Rivera was grilling at a park in central Connecticut.
We have to enjoy it while it lasts because we had a lot of winter and we just have to enjoy it.
Only about one in three Connecticut homes has central air conditioning, so cities have opened cooling shelters in libraries and senior centers. Tyler Boxson is homeless and was thankful for a bottle of cold water from a construction worker in Hartford.
It doesn't make a difference whether it's hot or cold out. I'm always out in it. This is my daily life, being homeless, you know.
More seasonal temperatures in the 70s are expected again in New England later in the week. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Lewis in Middletown, Connecticut.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 24 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. The Department of Homeland Security is warning about what it calls a heightened threat environment in the U.S. That's after President Trump's decision to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities over the weekend. The FBI's number two official says the agency is staying vigilant against any possible violence on U.S. soil. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas is covering this, and he's with us now to tell us more. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
So Iran already retaliated for the U.S. attack by firing missiles at a U.S. base in Qatar on Monday. But I take it they're still concerned about something happening here?
That's right. Well, the Department of Homeland Security put out a bulletin following the U.S. strikes on Iran over the weekend. And what DH said is that there are currently no specific credible threats against the U.S. homeland. But it does warn, as was noted at the top, of what it calls a heightened threat environment in the U.S. It warns of possible Iranian cyber attacks against U.S. computer networks, possible acts of violence or anti-Semitic hate crimes. And DHS and the FBI also held a call with state and local law enforcement the day after the U.S. strikes to make sure that they're aware of the potential threats from Iran on American soil. Of course, there's now this shaky ceasefire in place, but it's unclear what impact that could have on Iran's intentions down the line.
Could you just say more about what Iran could try to do in the U.S. to retaliate if it chose to do so?
Well, the closest historic precedent would be how Iran responded when the U.S. killed a top Iranian general in a drone strike in 2020, so in the last year of Trump's first term in office. And in that instance, Iran first fired missiles at a U.S. military base in Iraq, but it didn't stop there. Iran took its time, and more than a year later, according to U.S. officials, it began targeting top political and military officials here in the U.S. for assassination. The Justice Department, in fact, announced charges in 2022 against an Iranian operative for orchestrating a murder-for-hire scheme to kill former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton, other former top military generals, former senior Trump administration officials, and in fact, even Trump himself were also allegedly targets of Iranian plots. And just last November, the Justice Department said it had disrupted an Iranian plot to kill Trump himself.
Well, and obviously the plot against Trump was foiled, but to be clear, none of the other plots succeeded either. So what should we draw from that?
Well, look, the U.S. has been a difficult place for the Iranians to operate in the alleged plots. Court papers have shown that Iran security services basically had to farm out the work, hiring in many instances criminals to carry out these alleged plans in the U.S. And these folks haven't always been brimming with competence. So these plots have been foiled, but that doesn't mean that the threat isn't real. It was serious enough that for years the U.S. government provided security details for the former officials who were targeted. But important to note here, Trump revoked nearly all of those security details when he returned to office.
So what is the FBI doing now to try to protect against these possible Iranian threats, noting, as you just did, that the president has revoked all the security details for people who were known to be targets?
Well, Deputy FBI Director Dan Bongino has said on X that FBI assets are fully engaged and the Bureau remains vigilant. In these sorts of circumstances, one former senior FBI counterterrorism official told me that what the Bureau would be doing is keeping close tabs on any suspects with ties to the Iranian government who are already under investigation. They'd make sure that they have eyes and ears on them, know what they're doing. But I'm told it's important that the resources being put into addressing this potential threat from Iran stay on this issue, because Iran has shown in the past that it's willing to take its time, weeks, months, even years, to try to hit back.
That is NPR's Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
An influential committee of vaccine advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention begins a two-day meeting in Atlanta this morning. Now, the panel often meets in obscurity, but now it's in the spotlight. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fired the previous panel members 2 weeks ago and named replacements. NPR's Ping Wong joins us now to talk about what's at stake. So, Ping, some people may have first heard about this committee when RFK Jr. fired all 17 of its members. Can you tell us what this group actually does?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and usually they meet about three times a year. And these are advisors that make recommendations to CDC on how vaccines that have been already approved by the Food and Drug Administration, how those vaccines should be used to protect public health, you know, like who should get which vaccines and when, and their votes affect what insurers cover and what kids have access to. Now, their meetings, like the one that starts today, have to be public, and that's meant to build trust in vaccine recommendations, which are then ultimately made by the CDC's director.
So what's supposed to happen at today's meeting?
Okay, so they're usually really predictable, but this meeting is going to be pretty different.
Oh boy.
And that's because RFK Jr. has replaced the entire panel. It's a move that he said that he made to restore public trust. But I talked with a former CDC official named Dr. Fiona Havers. And in the past, she's presented at these meetings and she's helped support them. But she quit the agency last week after RFK Jr.'s purge of the panel. She thinks that's a move that undermined trust.
I knew I was done at that moment. I did not feel, for my own scientific and personal integrity, that I could present to this committee and help legitimize them.
Wow, okay. So what can we tell from who RFK Jr. has named to be on the committee?
So there's new members, and many of them do not actually have deep expertise in vaccines. In fact, some of them rose to prominence in recent years by spreading misinformation about them. So, for instance, there's Retzef Levy, who's a professor at MIT. He has said on social media that COVID vaccines are killing young people and must be stopped. Dr. Robert Malone has suggested that COVID vaccines may cause cancer. To be super clear, neither of these claims check out as facts. And Malone and another new member, Martin Kulldorff, have also both been paid to serve as expert witnesses in litigation against the vaccine maker Merck. So vaccine advocates are worried that this panel could be dismissive of vaccines, even discourage their use. And there's already a few things on the agenda that they point to that have long been priorities for people who question vaccines.
Ooh, like what are those?
Okay, so there's a vote scheduled over thimerosal, which is a preservative used in influenza vaccines. So back in the mid to late 90s, there were theories that thimerosal could be a cause of autism in children. That claim has long been debunked, but, you know, even so, manufacturers have voluntarily removed it from childhood vaccines. It's used infrequently today, and there hasn't been much new research on it for years, but it is still listed as something the group is going to consider. Also, there's going to be a discussion of the MMRV vaccine. That's a combo vaccine for measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella, or chickenpox. Now, years ago, there was evidence that it was linked with seizures during fevers in some young children, and the committee addressed it then by recommending that young kids be vaccinated separately for chickenpox. That is a recommendation that hasn't changed in 15 years, but it's now also on the agenda for discussion. So this is going to be a very closely watched meeting, and how it goes could say a lot about where the nation's vaccine policy is headed.
All right, that's NPR health correspondent Ping Wong. Thanks for the heads up.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
A ProPublica investigation finds the FDA allowed foreign factories to send tainted prescription drugs to American patients. That's next time on Here and Now.
News stories do not wait to unfold. They just happen. And when they do, no matter where you are, NPR helps you stay connected. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org on your phone.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Alarm clock, wake-up call, so passé. A Chinese hotel has another way of waking up their guests, a red panda. Think raccoon, but maybe a little cuter and red. The hotel brings one of their four resident red pandas to your room, and with the aid of apple chunks, lets it climb onto your bed. Guests love it, local officials don't. The Forestry Bureau has asked the hotel to stop, citing concerns about safety and animal welfare. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Martinez. A banner in Venice this week showed the laughing face of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos blown up to giant proportions and spread across a plaza in Venice, Italy. Above the image, activists put the words, "If you can rent Venice for your wedding, you can pay more tax." It's one of several efforts meant to protest or even disrupt Bezos' wedding to Lauren Sanchez this week. Tabloids report the celebrations have already begun. People magazine, for example, published pictures of the couple at a foam-filled party on Bezos' superyacht. The Wall Street Journal's Margherita Sancati is also reporting on the wedding buildup and joins us now from Rome. So a big destination wedding with one of the world's richest people. What do we know about the festivities and who's going to be there?
So we know very little because this event has been shrouded in secrecy. Wedding organizers have been extremely diligent about keeping the details of the wedding under wraps. But we do know it will be at least a three-day affair and mostly running from Thursday to Saturday. We know it's going to be a star-studded event that will happen across the city's tiny islands. And some of the guests are here already. We've seen images of Ivanka Trump and her husband, Jared Kushner, and their kids. We have at least one super yacht moored in the city. And we know there will be about 200 guests.
Okay, I've seen a DiCaprio sighting. I've seen a Kardashian sighting. So, yeah, definitely a star-studded event in Venice. So tell me, though, I mean, so why do activists want to disrupt the whole thing in the first place?
So Venetians are upset because they are tired of their city being used as a backdrop for luxury events, and also because it reinforces this image of Venice essentially as a playground for tourists. So it's not just about Jeff Bezos. It's about how the city has transformed and how it continues to transform. Venetians have an ambivalent relationship with tourism. The city's economy entirely depends on it. But residents say that they feel outnumbered, and they literally are. You know, on an average day, tourists far outnumber the people who actually live there. And they're pushing back against this image of Venice as a theme park. And by the way, some tourists literally think Venice is a theme park. And they've asked locals questions such as, you know, where is the exit and what time does it close?
I wish that weren't true, but I can totally picture tourists thinking that Venice is an actual theme park. Wow. All right. So what do wedding planners and the local government have to say about all this?
So the local government is really upset that these activists are threatening to disrupt the celebration because they're really in favor of this particular event, but also of this kind of tourism. You know, they want to encourage high net worth individuals from spending time and money in Venice. What they don't want, you know, day trippers who maybe spend 2 hours in Venice and leave just with a sandwich in their hands. So they're worried about the damage this could do to Venice's image and that it could discourage high net worth individuals from coming to the city.
You mentioned how Venice relies on tourism, but is there any concern about over tourism in Venice?
Absolutely. You know, the population of Venice is around 50,000 people, and most days tourists far outnumber that. And to tackle over-tourism, the local government last year actually introduced a daily entry fee on busy days. But, you know, it has done little to dissuade visitors from descending en masse on the city. And if anything, residents complain, it actually reinforces this perception of Venice as a theme park.
All right, that's Margherita Stancati of the Wall Street Journal from Rome. Margherita, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. A remarkable and unusual scene took place outside a Massachusetts courtroom last week. Hundreds of people, many wearing pink T-shirts, erupted into cheers and tears upon news of a verdict. They were there to support a woman named Karen Reed, who'd been accused of killing her Boston police officer boyfriend with her SUV during a snowy January night in 2022. Why the strong reaction? Well, some had been persuaded by the defense theory that the boyfriend had actually been killed by fellow cops, who then conspired to frame Reed. But others who followed the case said some of the reaction was due to outrage at unprofessional conduct by police during the investigation, including notably from the lead investigator, Michael Proctor. So does this case tell us anything about the public's trust in law enforcement? I asked David Sarney this. He's a retired NYPD detective and adjunct professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, who teaches police ethics, among other courses.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of, I'm not going to say unethical, but you're looking at some things that were, you know, the investigator, unfortunately, from an outsider point of view, put himself in an unprofessional demeanor between the text messages to his friends. You know, the professional protocols may not have been established properly, the chain of custody, the recovery of evidence, all those things came into play.
Let me just back up here for people who did not follow this as closely as other people did, that some of the things that stood out were just, first of all, the way the evidence was collected, using a leaf blower to clear snow away from the scene. People questioned, gee, did that disrupt evidence? Investigators didn't search the house. But what was most damning was these text messages that the lead investigator sent to friends. At the first trial, he had to read them aloud. He disparaged Karen Reed. He mocked her. He suggested that, you know, he hoped that she would kill herself. So you don't think that was unethical?
Here's the issue is, if you're the lead investigator, you have to be beyond reproach. And the key to everything is, it's an unbiased investigation. You have to determine by the totality of circumstances and the facts available. When you start disparaging victims and perpetrators and subjects and along those lines, it decimates your credibility. It decimates your unbiased operation of the investigation.
Do you think there's a broader issue here with the way the public views law enforcement? Because in recent years, there have been a number of these high-profile cases where police conduct has been an issue. I mean, obviously, in the case of George Floyd or the case of Tamir Rice, his 12-year-old was playing with a BB gun, and then the police shot him within, like, literally minutes of coming upon him. And I just wonder, do you think that there's a broader issue here of credibility that has been eroded by these cases of police misconduct?
Well, when you see these things, you'll see an erosion. You will see that, because high-profile cases, videos that come out without any context, people make these decisions based on 15, 20 seconds, 30 seconds of video. And that's the thing, the totality of the investigation, the totality of the incident that takes place. The Tamir Rice, yeah, and these, you know, we talk about issues of use of deadly force. And in this case, you know, split second decisions are made and let the investigation happen. That's, unfortunately, we have lost that, because the court of public opinion is much faster to respond to that. That's why when it comes to this investigation, the Karen Reed trial and the Karen Reed case, it is specific to the Commonwealth. It's specific to the Karen Reed investigation. But you will see investigations that take place in other places, Connecticut, New York City, New York State, where investigators are beyond reproach. Their investigations are honorable, respectful, but you don't get the media coverage for that.
Is there something that you will draw from this going forward as you continue to teach police procedure?
I want to always make sure that people who are going to law enforcement, who need to understand law enforcement, understand the whole process. And if you're going into the position of a police officer, if you're going that, you should know the good and bad side of it. It's a very positive job. It's a profession. If you treat it as such, if you bring the attitude and effort to do it the right way, in every sense of the way, and that's really what it comes down to.
That's David Sarney. He's a retired NYPD detective, and he's a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Professor Sarney, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, and take care.
People across the U.S. are currently sweating through a heat wave. Maine and other northern states like it has been considered a climate refuge in recent years. But Maine Public Radio's Molly Enking reports it didn't feel like much of a refuge yesterday.
At a pick-your-own strawberry farm on a hillside in the small town of Pownall, Maine, it's 10 a.m. and 95 degrees. Out front, a farm stand holds a dozen pints of huge, red, ripe berries. Farmer Dwight Ely is already done with his day. Not because he wants to be, but because in this unusual heat, he has to be.
Our day started at about 5 o'clock because we wanted to get out here and get the irrigation system going and pick some berries ourselves early so that we'd have them on the stand.
And prepare to welcome customers.
Almost all of them are regulars, yeah.
Who, despite the heat, showed up to pick their own by 7 a.m.
If I may say, the picking is good enough so that nobody was here that long.
By 10, it's too hot to continue. Ely and his farm manager put up a sign, Bradbury Mountain Berry Farm's Pick Your Own is done for the day. They cover the crop of strawberries with plastic shade cloth and hope for the best. This year, these berries have seen it all. Drought in the winter, an extremely rainy spring, unseasonably late frost, and now Ely's hoping they survive this extreme heat too.
I don't know if the plants will die, but the berries certainly will cook. Nothing we can do about it. The plants that are coming into production, they usually have a little bit more energy, and so I think they're gonna be okay. We'll find out.
At a popular state park down the road from the strawberry farm, the playground and parking lot sit empty. But it's another story the next town over on the coast, at Winslow State Park in Freeport, says Kendra Williams, who works at the front gate.
Today it's been really busy, yeah.
By now, it's 96 degrees, and the humidity is making it feel worse. Much like wind chill will make a cold day feel even colder, high humidity can make 96 feel like...
Live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. In a minute, President Trump will take questions from reporters at a press conference at The Hague, where he's been participating in the NATO summit. This is happening while the world watches to see whether a ceasefire between Israel and Iran will last. And on the heels of U.S. strikes at Iran nuclear facilities, let's go to the president right now.
In fact, I want to bring some back with me. I want to also thank, I had breakfast this morning, the king and queen and their incredible people. I said, you're central casting, beautiful people, great people, big, beautiful heart. And I enjoyed that. And also NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, who's been terrific. He's been a friend of mine, used to be right here running this wonderful country. Now, as the NATO Secretary General, is doing a fantastic job, and the Prime Minister.